Welcome to Tibet Talks, a podcast series from the International Campaign for Tibet. We hope you enjoy the show.
Tashi Dala, everyone, and welcome to our first Tibet Talks of 2024. I'm Ashwin Verghese of the International Campaign for Tibet, and I'm joined here by my colleagues, ICT President Tencho Gatso and ICT Germany Executive Director Kai Muller. Thank you both so much for being here today. On today's episode of the show, we're going to be talking all about China's upcoming Universal Periodic Review at the UN Human Rights Council, which will take place just next week on Tuesday, January 23rd. Now, throughout this discussion, we want to hear from you. Kai will be leaving for Geneva in just a couple days, and he'll be on ground during the UPR. And he's with us here on Tibet Talks today to answer any questions you have about the UPR and what it means for Tibet. So send us your questions for Kai or Tenchala by posting them in the comment section of our Facebook Live post or by emailing comments@savetibet.org. Tenchala has a few questions for Kai to get the conversation started. So with that, Tencho, I will hand it off to you.
Thank you very much, Ashwin. And thank you, Kai. I know it's evening for you, so thanks for joining us from Berlin. It's nice to have you on the show with us.
Hello, Tencho. Hello, Ashwin. Thank you for having me today. Good evening from Berlin.
So, Kai, let's start with maybe you can tell us what is the United Nations Universal Periodic Review and why is it important?
Well, the Universal Periodic Review happens every 5 years for every member state of the United Nations. For China, it's the fourth time they're being reviewed. And this happens as a routine, if you will, in the Human Rights Council in order to assess and ultimately to improve or promote the human rights in the respective country. So for China, this is particularly important because, better to say, for the international community and all those affected by the policies of the CCP, it's so important for all of them because it's a very rare occasion to publicly discuss the policies of the Chinese government towards the Tibetans, the Uyghurs, the Hong Kongers, and the Chinese defenders. This doesn't happen too often, rarely so, one must say. So this is really a unique opportunity to publicly hold the Chinese government accountable.
Kai, so maybe in that scenario, could you explain who are the participants in this UPR process? What is what is the role of member nations? The Chinese obviously will be there with a large delegation. So what are the different entities and how does it work?
Yes, the UPR is a peer review. That means that it is the states, the member states of the Human Rights Council, 47, plus the observer states, so all other United Nations members, to direct questions, to ask, express concern, criticism, and to make recommendations towards the Chinese government with regard to human rights issues they see pertinent and they see problematic in China. And this is a litmus test, if you will, for the international community, how much concern they are willing to express, how much political capital, for example, a country like Germany or France or Britain or the United States, are willing to invest in vis-a-vis the Chinese government, because it means, of course, that the Chinese government will not be particularly appreciative of criticism as they are. And this, the more as we are, we have reason really to for concern that there are grave human rights violations occurring not just in Tibet but in other areas in the Uyghur region in East Turkestan, for example. Mm-hmm. And this makes it the more important, and as I said, as a litmus test for the international community to express concern and how much they are willing to invest for the improvement of human rights.
You said that China will be questioned over there on human rights. So can you give us an example of how it would be, what are likely to be addressed, and how strong would the statements be?
Yes, we already got an idea through this ongoing process what countries may want to address next Tuesday. There is the opportunity for states to hand in, if you will, advanced questions, mm-hmm. and they have done so. And along those advanced questions, one can sort of guess or sense what kind of issues states are willing to raise and how much they want to raise and how many issues they want to raise. So this time we're looking at issues specifically with regard to Tibet, but also beyond. But I want to focus here on Tibet. That's, of course, the boarding schools, the so-called residential boarding school system in Tibet, the infringements on religious freedom that is quite prevalent in Tibet, for example, with regard to the management of monasteries, the intervention in the curricula, the intervention in the freedom of movement of monks, and lastly, and most importantly, in the intervention into the appointment of Buddhist teachers, foremost, of course, His Holiness the Dalai Lama. Along those issues, there are further issues of arbitrary detention of Tibetans. ICT has been advocating, for example, for a long time on the detention of Tibetan environmental defenders. Mm-hmm. So that has been raised by countries. My home country gladly raised this issue in their advanced questions already. And other issues relate to, in principle, the obvious apparent attempt of the Chinese government to severely undermine, if not eradicate, the Tibetan culture through their so-called Sinicization policy. So it's quite a range of issues pertaining to Tibet, and that makes it the more urgent, as we believe, to raise these issues in a clear language and also in a straightforward manner. This is, well, quite of the essence next Tuesday's, in my view.
Kai, you mentioned that some of the advanced questions have already come out. How do you see this as compared to the previous UPR, which was in 2018?
Yes, these questions are encouraging. Also, the number of questions that have been tabled, they are, we can look at some 20 questions that have been raised by states with regard to Tibet specifically. That's considerably more than in 2018 when we were looking at some 9 or so questions that were handed in specifically with reference to Tibet. So this is an uptick, which should make us mildly optimistic, but I would be cautious to and wait until next Tuesday. We are, of course, urging governments, or we have urged governments for already a couple of months to be very straightforward next Tuesday. But this is already encouraging, I would say, and there are a number of states who have really handed in and raised a couple of very important issues with regard to Tibet.
Kai, earlier last month, December, we had almost 20 members of United States Congress sent a bipartisan letter to the Biden administration that the UPR is an important opportunity for United States to shine a light on human rights in violations in China, specifically also in Tibet. This morning, there was another letter by 4 bipartisan senators to the Secretary Blinken. Is this your expectation that United States will be a strong voice in this upcoming UPR, along with other nations?
Yes, I think the United States is clearly a pacemaker when it comes to raising issues with regard to Tibet, also with regard to the Uyghurs and the Hong Kongers. So other states are looking at and closely watching what the United States is tabling and is raising at the Human Rights Council. So this, it's of utmost importance that the United States, takes a lead here, sort of shows the way for other countries. That having said, I think it's equally important that European countries, Asian countries, other countries, Latin America also speak up. Also, we're looking at some African countries, for example. So it is important and vitally important that the United States shows the way in a way and presents itself as a pacemaker at the Human Rights Council. But equally, as I said, it's also up to others. And we are particularly here in Europe looking at European nations, but also beyond. And we hope that there will be some turnout in that regard, too.
Let me jump in here. Thank you both so much for this conversation so far. Seeing that we're getting some additional people joining us on Facebook, so welcome to all the new viewers. Let me share one question that we have received already. Question is, what mechanisms, if any, are set in place to monitor the human rights situation inside Tibet after the UPR process? So good question there. Is that something one of you would be able to address?
Yeah, it's indeed a good question and also a tricky one because there is no specific mandate. For example, independent human rights expert that regularly monitors the situation in Tibet, in East Turkestan, elsewhere, and reports and then discusses at the Human Rights Council with regard to findings, developments, and so forth. This has been actually quite a unprecedented appeal. So expressing also the urgency among independent experts, as it were, at the time, because 2020, a group of such 50 independent United Nations experts have called for such a mechanism to be established at the Human Rights Council. Until today, this hasn't happened. It hasn't materialized. There hasn't even been a resolution to establish such a instrument been introduced into the Human Rights Council, really clearly showing problems and the impediments that exist at the Human Rights Council. But this is something that needs to be still on the agenda. We are pushing for it. It's not forgotten. It's unprecedented. In the meantime, we are urging those instruments such as independent special mandate holders, special rapporteurs on torture, on freedom of religion, on cultural rights, on the Child Rights Committee, the Committee Against Torture, which will also soon be reviewing China again, to address issues that civil society bring forward to them, cases of people, of Tibetans who are being persecuted, detained, tortured, or worse even, so that they be made public and addressed also in this court, if you will, in this arena of the Human Rights Council in Geneva. So there are ways to address these issues without these mechanisms, but as said, there's enough reason, I'd say, unfortunately, for such a special mandate to be established. Unfortunately, it hasn't materialized so far.
Thank you, Kai, for that. And thanks for the question. And just a reminder again, please keep sending in those questions. And with that, I will pass it back to Tencho.
Thank you, Ashwin. Kai, you mentioned civil society and you're leading ICT's efforts there in Geneva, along with the Tibet Coalition team there, working there. So can you share a little more detail into the avenues, the opportunities, the challenges you have working there? And
yes, the Human Rights Council should or offer space for civil society organizations such as ICT and others, such as the Tibet Advocacy Coalition that's very active in Geneva, for example, offers space to address these issues, to have side events or panel discussions in the very, very building of the Human Rights Council inside the United Nations, which is important because one has a particular outreach to those decision makers, to diplomatic corps, and so forth. So that is really significant for civil society to engage. It's really important to engage because despite all of the shortcomings that the United Nations unfortunately represent and display on a regular basis, one must say, despite these shortcomings, it is one still the most influential arena where these issues can be discussed publicly, internationally. So it's hugely important for civil society to be there, but also being mindful that our space, as it's called, as it's been addressed in the past already, that civil society space is under attack, that it's shrinking or threatened in a way, because it's autocratic countries who try to limit the influence of civil society organizations such as ours, because they don't want to hear the criticism. They don't want to deal with, you know, this negative image that may come, that may be a result of such criticism. But we are just relaying the reality. So we are just the messenger. But it is, of course, in the vital interest of an autocratic country to undermine or stifle criticism wherever they can. So we are also have to deal with these, you know, tendencies to limit our influence. And we see it here and there. Mm-hmm. But I think so far, particularly also the Tibet organizations have really made a very valuable contribution, not just to the UPR process, but also beyond. There are many other processes. And I think organizations such as ICT, such as Tibet Advocacy Coalition, and all NGOs that are organized in all of these networks, they really make a difference. And I think I'm confident that we have managed to make a difference and a good contribution to this UPR process.
You mentioned we are relaying the message. So what I wanted to bring up also, last week we had a letter from faith leaders ranging from Tibetan to Uyghur to Jewish who wrote to the UNHRC president about the freedom of religion in China. We have also had ICT member petitions, and likewise other Tibet groups are doing member petitions. So what are the significance of these steps as they strengthen the work over there?
Well, the support from members, from supporters in countries such as the United States or Germany or the Netherlands, France, Britain, or elsewhere, is hugely important, because it gives us really the energy and also the impulse to really to be present and to address these issues with urgency. And this support, taken into account also by decision makers and by stakeholders we are talking to. So it's not just a signature or a letter, but this is being taken a note of by those stakeholders, decision makers. It's so important also to make clear to our interlocutors, to people we talk in government offices, it's not just us, but there are people out there who are actively have an interest, and they express their interest through the signatories, through any means of support they can offer for those NGOs. And actually, personally, I'm always very happy to read messages of support by email from any supporters we have, and that's really very nice and very encouraging, and gives us me personally some energy and persistence that is needed to navigate, I mean, through these difficult waters at the United Nations together with my colleagues and other NGOs. Mm-hmm. So that's really important.
I agree with you, really. Hearing from members and hearing that people care about these issues that affect Tibetans and others gives us inspiration and renewed energy to work. Kai, I want to ask you, so how has China responded to previous UPR recommendations?
Yeah, it's, China basically, let me look at the numbers. Since you asked, I've already shared some numbers with you. There have been quite a lot of recommendations made in the last UPR process, in the last review. And I'm looking at some 300 something, and
they just deny everything and brush it off.
Yeah, it's most of them are being brushed off, which is no surprise given the overall attitude of the Chinese government, also at the Human Rights Council. So that's not really a surprise. But what matters really is what countries actually invest into those processes, what they are willing to state or to raise as a recommendations. Here I'm looking at actually it's the largest, the biggest amount of recommendation has actually been accepted, but most of the recommendations made during the process at the Human Rights Council are coming from countries that do not really have the intention to raise serious issues with the Chinese government here. So it is actually it's an easy questions that are being put, easy recommendations, and they can just easily be accepted. But those who really matter, where, for example, states recommend improvement in terms of arbitrary detention, torture, improvement in terms of treatment of Tibetans and Uyghurs, those are all brushed off and just flatly denied. Actually, we do not expect much else to happen next Tuesday, but this is not really what's it about. It's about how many states are going to really invest political capital into this process with regard to Tibet. Basically, I do not expect the Chinese government, also having read their national report, which they had to submit, also after having read this report, I'm not expecting any surprise there.
So, Kai, you said Tuesday the countries will be having their time for the questions. So how does that work? Is there limited time? And just give us a sense of what will be going on in the room there.
Yeah, basically all member states, all 193 countries have the opportunity to raise questions. It starts at 9 a.m. and it's over at 12:30, so shortly after noon. So you can imagine to put all those countries and recommendations along with a response from the Chinese government to that short period of time allows only a very short space for countries to raise issues. So they have, if I'm not mistaken, something like 90 seconds or 2 minutes to raise issues and recommendations with the Chinese government. And that's not a lot, but still it forces countries to really to raise important issues. And we want Tibet to be among the important issues. It's going to be a very tense process. I will be in the room at the Human Rights Council on that day. And what I experienced in 2018 was a massive presence of Chinese diplomats and Chinese NGOs, so-called NGOs, I should say, because they are all very much aligned with the Communist Party policies. So they are, if one could say, parroting the party line there. But it's quite impressive and also makes one feel a little uncomfortable, I'd say, to be in a room with such a overwhelming presence of the party state there. I expect nothing less than what I've experienced in 2018.
Thanks, Kai. Thanks, Tencho. Getting some questions coming in here. And so we have a question here from Mingmar Saring on Facebook. And Mingmar Law is asking, kick China out of the UN. Is it possible to kick China out of the United Nations or these other organizations? And is that a good idea? What would the ramifications of that be? Is there something you can comment on?
I don't know whether it's going to be a good idea. It's not going to be possible. I mean, that makes any further thinking about irrelevant. Probably not Mingmar will probably not be happy about this response, but it's simply not possible. China, on the other hand, is a member of the Security Council, is one of the big five nations being at the United Nations. It's not it's not realistic to work towards that, to expect this. So it makes it rather irrelevant to spend more thoughts about this, I'm afraid.
Thanks, Kai. And thanks, Mingmar Zhengla, for sharing that question. And show back to you.
Yeah, Kai, on that note, I wanted to ask you, what are you've been planning some events around the UPR. What are the other things that will happen outside of that? Tell us.
Yes, we are helping to organize a so-called site event at the United Nations at the Human Rights Council next Monday with, I think, extraordinary panelists, and which includes the representative of the Dalai Lama in Geneva, Tinglin Chuki, which includes director of the Tibet Action Institute, Larun Tetor, and which includes our own Bucho Tsering, the head of our monitoring research unit in DC. I myself will have the honor to moderate this event. We are hoping for a good turnout from the side of diplomats. It's really geared at this kind of audience. And we want to make clear, we want to also show that the Tibet issue is relevant and that we as civil society organizations are visible. And we are very much so present in the very building with our own event that exclusively focuses on Tibet. This is for us at ICT, one important event. There are many others around the session which are being organized by other Tibet groups and other cross movement, if you will, groups. And there will be a rally outside the United Nations building from also in the morning on Tuesday, organized by Tibetans. And I hear Uyghurs are also involved. So there's going to be a public sort of event outside the building to protest the situation in Tibet and in East Turkestan. And then there's a press conference also by Tibet groups with other groups in the afternoon. So lots of things going on there. And I think it's a good display of advocacy and I think also serious concern and also substantial contribution to the process, because all of the groups have really made a great effort to be substantial, to convey concern issues and explain them and made a lot of recommendations what should be done. So there's no scarcity of recommendations, of ideas, of issues that have been raised. And I think that really shows that the Tibet movement is really very vital at the moment. And that's really good.
All right. Well, thank you very much. One more question here from the audience so far. And you kind of touched on this a little bit already, obviously, throughout this discussion. But what are some tangible results that we can hope to see or that could be possible once the UPR is over?
Well, I think the UPR could be another little mosaic in a larger picture, because the advocacy and the engagement with China needs to continue. This is an important stepstone, if you will, for further engagement. And I think it could give energy, it could energize states, it could energize civil society, the larger international community, it could energize media. So there's not a renewed, but a more intense or more thorough interest into what's going on in Tibet, because as we all know, it's there is this strategy of to cut off Tibet from the flow of information, to shut down information from and to Tibet, so the world does not cannot see what is actually going on. And in the meantime, the Chinese government disseminating their narratives about what allegedly is going on in Tibet, of course, all to the positive for the Tibetans. I think the UPR could energize. And at the end, I think we also need to look at the long run, really, with Tibet. And I think a lot of Tibet activists, a lot of Tibetans know that, for the better or worse, I should say, that is really we're in for the long game here, and UPR should energize to continue working on this issue.
I think if I might add also,
yeah.
Since the last UPR, CTA has also been organizing the Geneva Forum there annually, and I think you along with others have really increased the work that we've been doing in Geneva, and probably an impact of this is why we see a reaction. Hopefully afterwards, after all this, we'll have a better assessment from you as well, Kai.
No, I think it's really important that the exile government, that the offices of Tibet are engaging. They do, and I can only welcome this. We are supportive wherever we can, wherever it's needed, and wherever we are being asked. And I think they are really the most important players there when it comes to Tibet issue. That's what we want to support, because them really who are in the driver's seat here.
Thank you, Kai. We're actually starting to get some questions coming in pretty quickly here, actually. So that's great. Question from Anita Hagelin, and this is a very specific question. Do you know if Sweden will come up with any recommendations for China regarding Tibet? I don't know if Sweden is a member of the council, but...
We hope so. Sweden is an important country, and I need to look it up, but I think they have also submitted an advanced question, actually the day before yesterday when they got published. So that's what we hope Sweden to do. Sweden is traditionally a human rights positive, if you will, country when it comes to Tibetans. There's broad support also in Sweden, in civil society. There's some Tibet organizations, some of the oldest, I think, in Europe, if I'm not mistaken. So I hope very much that Sweden will be among the states that really speak up next week.
Thank you very much for that. Another question here. This is from Thundub Sering, who is well known to us, and I believe a member of the Tibetan Parliament. The question is, who will be representing the U.S. to the UN Universal Periodic Review, and how can Tibetan Americans contact them? I'll share that with both of you. Tenshila, obviously, you're here in the U.S., and Kai, you're there with the UN. So is there anything we can share about that?
Kai, I think you would know better. Here, we've been engaging with the Secretary of State office here and with Undersecretary Zaya's office, who is our connection to the Biden administration. But they're in Geneva. Maybe, Kai, you can.
Yeah, I think maybe I can respond to this question by saying all of the decisions are being made in the capital. So in the case of the U.S., of course, Washington, D.C. and the State Department or the government altogether. Same goes for countries like Germany, France, UK, and all others, basically. In Geneva, it's routinely the mission, the representative of the state in the mission of the United States or Germany in Geneva, who take the floor and or whose staffer are taking the floor there. So I do not know who specifically is going to represent the United States there. They will be represented through diplomatic personnel, for sure. But as said, I think the main decisions are being made in the capitals. I would sense there's always some sort of a feedback between the mission on the ground and the capital as it is.
Thank you very much. And all these questions are great, everyone. Thank you so much. Please keep them coming in, and we will try to get to all of your questions here before we wrap up in a few minutes. We have another question here that's dealing with the issue of the Tibetan language and suppression of that within Tibet. So I'm just wondering if that's something you can comment on about kind of what's the state of China's crackdown on the Tibetan language inside Tibet.
Yeah, I mean, we have been observing, unfortunately, quite a negative trend over the past decade or so. I mean, the most pressing issue that well, probably everybody knows out there is the boarding school issues, where the issue of language is a really elemental or fundamental part of the issue, because we know that so-called bilingual education means in practice that Chinese is the medium of instruction. And that's really the problem, that as schools and education have switched to Chinese as medium of instruction, while the Tibetan language is reduced to some sort of a everyday language of families or so. But and I recall one statement which really struck me at the time when I was monitoring the dealings of the UN Social Committee with China last year. So they had a big review in February in Geneva, and Tibetan language was also a very pressing issue that was raised by the independent experts with the Chinese delegation. And one Chinese member of the delegation of the government flatly stated or claimed that the Tibetan language was not suitable or appropriate or whatever shaped, whatever form, to express modern terminology of technology, of infrastructure development, and so forth. So this was really striking. So he denied that the Tibetan language was actually capable of being something that can be used in modernity or in present day. And that was, of course, hugely discriminatory. And I think that somewhat exemplifies exemplified for me how their approach to the Tibetan language is. It's for that, for in the attitude or mentality of the Communist Party, obviously a impediment to development. And that is something that is really a totally outdated perception of language per se. So that made me very, very, along with my concerns that I already had, it was very striking.
Yep. If I might add also over there, when you talk about the modernity of the language, we just had a visitor here in our office, Geshe Mulam, who's been at the forefront of digitizing Tibetan language and bringing it to the modern world and connecting with AI and all the developments in technology. In fact, he's going around the United States in meetings in Silicon Valley and other places, also linking the value of Tibetan Buddhist, the Tibetan philosophy and trainings of the mind that can be connected and that can be beneficial for the world of technology as they develop AI and look to new areas and how that can benefit towards building an AI that looks outward to benefiting others and how that can be a positive influence. So I think in that sense, there are areas also where Tibetan language can be beneficial in that respect.
Thank you both. We're getting close to the end of the program here. I'll share one last question, and unfortunately then we are going to have to wrap up. But thank you again so much to everybody who's been engaging. It's amazing to see the level of interaction here on Facebook, and we really appreciate not just you being part of this Tibet Talk, but your passion for Tibet, because that really keeps the whole movement going. I want to ask one question here from Tom Wenzel. Tom has been sharing a few questions, so thank you so much, Tom. Good question kind of for us to end it on. What can we do to get other countries to hold China accountable for what it's doing in Tibet? And I know it's kind of been a topic of the whole discussion, but just maybe any final words from the two of you.
Yeah, if you have the last word, Tenshu, if I might respond. I mean, it's a question that we are breaking our heads always, all the time over. So it's very relevant. And I think it's got much to do with popular support, with the understanding in certain countries. I'm looking at Southern Europe, Southern East Europe, as an example. If you look at the Balkans, you have a huge engagement of the Chinese state there in the economy. You have a lot of activity, economic cooperation in Africa or Latin America from the Chinese side. But I have seen suddenly NGOs from those countries being in Geneva and talking about China, because they understand from, the experience with the Chinese state cooperation, with the Chinese state, how detrimental their policies are in terms of the environment, in terms of social security, in terms of absurd infrastructure projects where money is being just dumped into such undertakings. So that is something very new. And I think from my end, I would hope such, you know, realization in those countries contributes that eventually governments involved, no states are not the usual suspects, if you will, to raise Chinese, to raise policies of the CCP, that those countries, governments also eventually come to the table and say, look, this is, we're concerned, we understand what kind of detrimental policies the Communist Party is implementing, not just in Tibet and East Turkestan, but also in our country. So we understand what your aspirations as Tibetans are. We understand what your grievances are. So we are with you. And that's something I'm looking with some optimism at. And let's see.
Fighting China's propaganda machine and the amount of money that they put into that. Here in the U.S., we have a bill that we are focusing on, promoting a resolution to the Tibet-China Dispute Act that includes language authorizing, looking to the State Department to act by China's disinformation campaign on Tibet's history, on Tibet's culture, on Tibet overall. So that's one of the areas that we are pushing on here, aside to help fight this disinformation. Yeah, I think on that note, I want to end, Kai, by thanking you and the team there for all the work on there, and I wish you also a successful side event there with the panelists, and we'll wait for your report back afterwards. So good luck to you and the team there.
Thank you very much.
Yes, best wishes, Kai, and thank you, Kai. Thank you, Tencho. This has been a really informative discussion. And again, I just want to thank everybody who's watching online so much. It's been really great to have you all as part of this conversation. So thank you for taking part. We will be back next month with another episode of Tibet Talks. Until then, as we always say on the show, stay safe, stay well, and stay active. Thank you, and tu jiji.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Tibet Talks. Subscribe to the show on iTunes, Spotify, or Google Podcasts. Learn more at savetibet.org/pod. To find out how you can get involved in our efforts to promote human rights and democratic freedoms for the people of Tibet, please visit savetibet.org/support. Thank you, and see you next time on Tibet Talks.